The Rock Lighthouse. One of the most heroic feats of engineering in maritime history.
You're out there fighting the elements. You're fighting nature on the front line.
Built to save the lives of thousands at sea.
There was a lot of shipping lost.
In the face of catastrophic storms.
The day you turn your back on the sea is the day you're going to die.
So how did they build them?
Whoa!
I'm Rob Bell, and I'm going behind closed doors to uncover staggering tales of innovation, epic adventure.
This is over 300 degrees, this lead I've got in here, right?
And danger. To reveal the secrets of some of the most extraordinary structures ever built. This time, Ireland's guardian of the Atlantic.
It's the last of the great rock lighthouses.
Built in terrible conditions that engineering struggled to conquer.
I stood here and I was afraid the dome would come off.
But today it stands as a beacon of scientific progress.
It might not look like it, but this is man-made lightning right here.
It's quite exciting.
The Fastnet Rock Lighthouse. The Atlantic Ocean. One of the most dangerous bodies of water in the world. And once mariners cross these seas, they're faced with yet another challenge. The jagged southwest coast of Ireland. Because of these dangers, lighthouse keeping has a long tradition in this part of the world. And it's all thanks to a man of faith.
In the 5th century, here in County Wexford, a monk called Duvon started lighting fires at the mouth of the bay so boats could safely find their way in.
For the last 1,500 years, there's always been a light here. In the 19th century, dozens of lighthouses were built around the coast of the Emerald Isle. In 1848, it was decided that a new beacon was needed to protect valuable transatlantic shipping. It was built 8 miles out to sea on Ireland's most southerly point, Fastnet Rock.
Ever since sailors first ventured out there, the origins of its name spoke for themselves. In Old Norse, it's said to mean sharp tooth. And in Gaelic, lonely rock.
Even before the lighthouse was built, the sight of this iconic rock has stirred up strong feelings for seafarers for generations, whether they were returning to the safety of home or leaving for good. Fastnet is practically seared into the consciousness of the Irish around the world. Because over 3,000 miles out to the west is New York.
And in 1847, the potato famine triggered mass migration from Ireland to America. And that rock, seemingly dangling off the tip of the country as it faces the new world, earned a new name, Ireland's Teardrop, as it was the last site of the motherland for the thousands of people fleeing poverty, persecution, and starvation for a new life.
So how do you go about building a lighthouse on a small, jagged rock 8 miles out to sea? An easy building material would have been brick. But the Fastnet's designer, George Halpin, knew that the mortar between the bricks wouldn't stand up to the battering of the sea. For this one, he was happy to go back to the drawing board.
There wasn't much the Victorians enjoyed more than a good old engineering challenge. And the first idea for that storm-lashed rock was to deploy the go-to building material in the 19th century, iron.
Across Europe, iron was so useful, they built everything from it, from the magnificent Crystal Palace to the tallest building of its day, the Eiffel Tower.
One of the great attractions of iron is not only that it's incredibly strong, but that iron plates can be firmly riveted together to form a watertight seal. The very first ship to be made entirely from iron, Brunel's SS Great Britain, transformed the world of shipbuilding. So if an iron ship can withstand the Atlantic Ocean, why can't an iron lighthouse?
George Halpin's bright idea was to use brick and iron together.
Let's get that up there. So this just shows basically the principle, how the lighthouse was built. You've got your simple brick tower on the inside, but then surrounded by these iron plates. This formed an armor-plated base around the bottom half of the lighthouse, which took most of the punishment from the waves. And for a while, it worked.
But what sort of conditions did the tower have to endure? Gerald Butler was one of the Fastnet's last keepers before it was automated in 1989.
It's gorgeous.
He's now attendant keeper of nearby Galley Head Lighthouse. But despite it being on dry land, it still has to face terrible Atlantic storms. Gerald has agreed to give me a privileged peek behind closed doors.
This is the glaring monster.
I mean, you can look out there and see it's choppy. You know, it's fairly stormy up here today, and you can hear the wind. But how does this compare to some of the conditions you've experienced when you've been out working in lighthouses?
Here, we had a storm there a few years ago, and the waves were breaking just outside of that Shunta rock there, and they were going right over the top of the lighthouse.
Unbelievable. I cannot imagine what that looks like.
I stood here, and I actually got a bit afraid here, so I left the lantern. I was afraid that the dome would come off. I've never seen the wind quite so strong as it was that night.
It almost feels like Mother Nature always throws surprises at us.
It does, and we just have to say that one day Mother Nature is going to win.
The iron and brick Fastnet Lighthouse was completed in 1854. But 28 years later, disaster struck. On the 26th of November, 1881, a furious storm lashed the Irish coast. The Fastnet's lantern was smashed and the lens was damaged. But this was trifling compared to the carnage that unfolded at a similar iron and brick tower. The nearby Calf Rock Lighthouse was snapped in half.
The terrified keepers managed to survive for 12 days before the storm subsided enough for them to be rescued.
The lighthouse was totally wrecked. But miraculously, all six of its keepers survived. After the catastrophe on Calf Rock, the authorities lost all faith in the iron and brick design. It was decided that a new lighthouse had to be built on Fastnet, and a more resilient material was needed, one that could stand for generations. They aimed high, literally, and created what is still the tallest lighthouse in the British Isles.
But this gargantuan struggle could have been for nothing were it not for people capable of levels of endurance and tenacity that beggar belief. The story of Fastnet's builders and keepers is a monument to human achievement.
And one man takes the credit of raising the tower that still stands to this day. The Fastnet Lighthouse. Standing strong for over a century, this tower has taken everything the Atlantic has thrown at it. After the demise of the nearby Calf Rock Lighthouse in 1881, it was clear that iron and brick wouldn't stand up to the elements. To construct a tower that would last, its designer, William Douglas, decided to build in stone. But working with masses of stone on this tiny island would be a huge task. And for a huge task, you need a huge character. That man was James Kavanagh.
This picture is a rare glimpse of James Kavanagh there stopping work to pose for a photograph on the tower. As foreman, he personally set every single one of Fastnet's 2,047 blocks by hand. And somewhere on Fastnet Rock is a cave known as Kavanagh's Hole, named so because he was so hell-bent on perfecting Fastnet, he'd sometimes spend the night in the cave. Kavanagh refused to leave the rock at all as long as work was going on, and that was for 7 years.
The lighthouse has a degree of perfection which could only have resulted from one person having completely innate supervision of its entire construction, and that was James Kavanagh. He's always distinguishable because he's wearing a pristine white jacket, and quite how he kept it clean on this quite difficult building site, God only knows. He organised and ran his men with a sort of stern, almost military efficiency, but, you know, despite the extreme difficulty and the very dangerous job that was being done. Fastnet was remarkable for the fact that there were no fatalities.
To better understand the challenges faced by Kavanagh and his crew, I'm meeting with Owen Lehane from Irish Lights, who manage all of Ireland's lighthouses.
Is this an original drawing, do we know?
These are dating from 1904. Mm. These have been hand-drawn at the time.
It just goes to show the challenge it must have been to decide where and how to build on this rock.
Absolutely. Fastnet Rock is literally a pinnacle of rock sitting in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, subject to all of the storms that the North Atlantic can throw you. I mean, they did this without any knowledge of what we would term today as our wave loadings, our sea rises, our climate change.
Wow.
Quarrying and transporting enough stone to build a lighthouse can be hugely expensive, so it made sense to use what's locally available. But in Southern Ireland, the landscape is mainly made of white limestone and red sandstone, rocks that might not take the pounding of the Atlantic. So the Fastnet designers looked at previous rock lighthouses. They were built from much stronger stuff, granite. It's time for me to take a look at the difference between sandstone and granite myself.
Now, I'm keen to try out my own highly scientific test. This is the best I can do. Let's try this sandstone first. It never stood a chance. OK, so now let's try granite. Right, I'll give that a bit more beans. The hammer's almost bouncing back off it. Unbelievable. Well, based on the results from my experiment, granite it is.
And indeed, in 1897, Kavanagh and his team took receipt of the first batch of what would ultimately be 4,300 tons of Cornish granite. But he knew that these blocks couldn't just be stacked up one on top of each other like a wall. It would collapse as soon as the first storm hit. Other stone lighthouses that predated the Fastnet used different methods to get around this issue.
The Fastnet is the last of the great rock lighthouses completed in 1904, and probably the most perfect of them, mainly because all of the lessons in rock lighthouse building had by then been learned.
At the Eddiston Lighthouse in Cornwall, designer John Smeaton had pioneered a technique more commonly found in carpentry, dovetailing. Every block was cut so that it interlocked perfectly with the ones around it. But at the Fastnet, they went even further. The first 10 courses of stone were built into the solid rock it sits on. And each block in the tower was dovetailed on every side, so it slotted snugly in with its neighbours above and below. Jeff McCarthy is another of the Fastnet's veteran crew.
Well, I'm standing beside a lump of granite now. It's 3 tonnes in weight, and it is an exact replica of one of the 2,074 stones that were quarried in Cornwall and shipped over to Ireland to construct the Fastnet. Each one of these, as you can see, it's dovetailed at the top, at the sides, and at the end. It has been reported that there's up to a 2-metre sway at the top of the lighthouse under full pressure of a wave. And being aboard the lighthouse, the whole unit moves as one. It's like a palm tree almost.
Despite the Fastnet's ability to shrug off the most terrifying waves, sheltering inside could still be a pretty hair-raising experience for its keepers.
During every storm, there is always what we might term a rogue wave. I have seen it, this massive explosion of water all around us. I was standing inside in the centre of the lighthouse, holding onto the kitchen sink, and I had to put my foot out to correct my balance. Water came in every little peephole it could, up through the kitchen sink. I wasn't afraid, I was young, and I always believed that fear goes with age, or let's say, maturity.
The expertly laid and dovetailed Fastnet Tower was topped out in 1903. But James Kavanagh didn't live to see its lantern lit.
Kavanagh finally bade farewell to Fastnet Rock in June 1903. Just a month later, he died suddenly from a stroke. Now, this humble engineer may not be as famous or celebrated as his towering creation, but for me, the obvious passion and determination that he poured into building this structure make James Kavanagh a giant of the engineering world.
A year after Kavanagh's death, the Fastnet's lamp was lit on the 27th of June, 1904. But before the Fastnet, lantern technology was rudimentary. Candles and simple oil lamps were the main methods for keeping mariners safe. These low-powered lamps had to be constantly cleaned and maintained to make sure they didn't snuff themselves out. But all that was about to change with the discovery of electricity. Cornishman Humphrey Davy was one of Britain's first electrical pioneers. In the first decade of the 1800s, Davy demonstrated what he called the carbon arc lamp, something that would have been an incredible sight in his dim, candle-lit lab. Struan Simpson is a PhD student at Aberdeen University, and he's going to show me how these arc lamps worked.
What is an electric arc exactly?
So an electric arc is the jumping of electricity from one point to another. So it was almost like we were kind of creating lightning in our own way and using that to light up our environment.
Can we see how that would have worked?
Sure. You've got these carbon rods. We're going to attach these to a crocodile clip and then push them together. It's actually contacting the carbon rods together that will complete that circuit. And that's what's going to give us our arc.
And why do we need carbon?
Carbon is quite essential to forming the actual electric discharge. So when you put the carbon rods together, what actually happens is you produce a flame between the carbon.
Well, let's see it in action. Yeah, there it is. Oh, it's bright.
It is quite bright, yes.
This is what the early arc lamps were, that discovery of the electric arc.
I mean, it might not look like it, but this is man-made lightning right here.
Absolutely. Behold.
Although it looks impressive, these batteries only add up to 24 volts.
With absolutely no offence, this is on quite a small scale, though.
It is indeed, yes.
Can we ramp things up a little bit?
Well, of course we can. Here is we've got a power amplifier. Now, that will take our mains voltage of 240 volts and push that right up to 2,000 volts. Goggles on, yep.
Very good.
So I'll plug this into the amplifier.
It's quite exciting.
There we go.
It's current.
And I'll pull them apart.
Wow, that is so bright.
Yeah.
The amount of energy that's coming out of there is unreal. That is an incredibly bright light. Even though I've got these on, you can hear it buzzing. That's another indication of the power and the energy in there. But I can feel the heat. Having a light source with this much intensity, this much power, compared to what it was beforehand, candles and oil lamps. It's chalk and cheese.
Absolutely, yep.
This was an absolute game changer. Incredible.
This amazing new technology should have been a real step forward for lighthouses. But in the early 19th century, arc lamps were powered by batteries. These huge batteries had the potential to save ships, but in doing so, might have killed their keepers. They were full of dangerous chemicals, and therefore far from ideal for use in a lighthouse. Could anyone come up with a solution?
Step up the scientific advisor to Trinity House, the institution that manages English and Welsh lighthouses. His name, Michael Faraday.
Faraday was one of the most respected minds of the Victorian era. But to test the arc lamp, his choice of laboratory was a little unusual. South Foreland Lighthouse in Kent.
The main experiments that Faraday undertook at the South Foreland Lighthouse for Trinity House was exploring the feasibility and the practicality of using electric light from batteries. The trouble is batteries in those days were enormous, full of acids, which produced pretty noxious fumes, and it really just didn't work.
Faraday decided that instead of batteries, he would apply his own theory, electromagnetic induction.
Faraday discovered that if you had a coil of wire like that and you passed a magnet through it, you generated a current. That's precisely the principle which all electricity to this day is generated.
At South Foreland, Faraday installed the first large-scale electric generator in the world.
This is really quite an extraordinary thing to do because it's really the first practical application of electric power on a big scale.
Faraday's pioneering work in lighthouse design paved the way for the mass generation of electricity we still enjoy today. And when his generator first ran in 1859, the arc lamp was so powerful it could easily be seen across the Channel in France. A very welcome sight for mariners navigating these troubled waters.
We'll never know how many lives have been saved by lighthouses like Fastnet over the last 200 years. But that's not all we have to be thankful to them for. As progress through the 20th century gathered pace, lighthouses were right there, always driving groundbreaking engineering forwards. But despite all the advances in technology, tragedy was still to come.
The Fastnet Lighthouse. A beacon in the darkness that's been saving lives in the Atlantic for over a century. But before there was a lighthouse here, this stretch of coast was witness to tragedy. The 10th of November, 1847. Thick fog blanketed the shoreline. The sail ship Stephen Whitney slid across the waves, full of passengers, bound for Liverpool. The captain was looking for the old Cape Clear lighthouse, but its lantern was invisible in the fog. Lost and blind, the Stephen Whitney ploughed straight into the rocks of West Calf Island.
Out of the 110 crew and passengers aboard, only 18 survived.
The lives lost on the Stephen Whitney could have been saved had the captain heard a foghorn.
Fog is one of the great fears of seafaring, because once your ship is enveloped in fog, you know, you're completely blind. You don't know where you're going. If a light can't penetrate the fog that surrounds it, then it's worse than useless.
We all know what a foghorn sounds like, right? It's something like this. Nowadays, that classic mournful sound of a gigantic horn has been replaced by more energy-efficient, electronically synthesized tones. But how did early lighthouse keepers meet the challenge of making a noise that could be heard for miles?
To understand more about early foghorn technology, I've come to meet Nigel Teggin at the National Maritime Museum of Ireland in Dunleary.
This is a hand-crank fog signal used on sailing ships in the old days. You should give it a go. We're just big kids, aren't we?
That is not the sound I was expecting to come out of a fog signal. This is a genuine fog signal.
That's a genuine fog signal, normally used, that would have been used in sailing ships.
Used on ships, but also used on lighthouses.
Yes, well, originally they would have used guns, because every ship in the old days, in sailing ship days, would have been armed. So if a ship was approaching port, it would fire a gun and expect the gun on the lighthouse to fire back at them. They went on to use bells, and then they used explosive fog signals, which was basically throwing a banger out the window. What they used to do is rig it up in an apparatus and hold it out to a safe distance and then set it off at regular intervals.
Something like this is part of that great big family of fog right. signals that have hopefully been keeping mariners safe for centuries.
That's right.
Well, I can't give myself a day. I have one more go just to as a parting part. That doesn't get annoying after a while, does it?
It beggars belief that before foghorns, lighthouse keepers had to use something as dangerous as explosives to warn ships. To find out how on earth this was achieved without blowing themselves to pieces, I've come to meet Dr. Roy Lowry of the University of Plymouth.
What might an explosive fog signal on a lighthouse have looked like?
It would be pretty small, but in those days, it would have been fired manually. So it would have a fuse out the top and you'd light that and then you'd run away. So you use a small amount of explosive to carry a noise through the fog. It's something called tonite.
That's a form of explosive, is it?
Yeah, its name gives it away. It's from the Latin to mean it thunders. So it's really loud.
You don't want large explosions that can move things.
Sure.
When you're surrounded by a load of glass.
Exactly, you're in a very confined space.
I understand that we can experience an explosive fog signal today.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Not actual tonite, but something very similar.
And it's one of these.
That's it?
Yeah.
It's like a party popper.
Yeah, it's one heck of a pop. And there's only about 4 grams of material in there. And if you've ever gone to a concert at Wembley where there was a loud bang in a finale,
yeah,
you've heard one of these.
Wow. Can we demonstrate? Can we hear how loud a blast from a charge this size is going to be?
Why not? Let's do it.
All right, lovely. I will let you do your bit up there. I'll stay out of your way. I'm not quite sure what to expect, how loud a bang to expect here, and I'm quite excited by that, I think.
We're ready to go, except you need a pair of these.
Good, yes, thank you for that. Oh, this looks good.
Testing.
Look at that, arm, click.
3, 2, 1.
I'm so thankful for these.
See what I mean about really short?
Yeah, so sharp and intense.
And really carries well. Use in lighthouses, you want something sharp.
The Fastnet started using an explosive fog signal in 1883. The explosive it used was gun cotton, also known as cotton powder. Irish Lights continued to use this on some lighthouses until the 1970s.
The cotton powder was very volatile. A lot of keepers had their fingers blown off using this stuff. During the War of Independence here, most of the lighthouses were raided by the IRA. The cotton powder charges were taken, and a lot of the fog signals had to be discontinued until the country settled down again.
Once fog signals were mechanised, there was no need for dangerous explosives. And the mournful sound of the foghorn echoed over the waves for much of the 20th century. But what made that sound in particular so successful?
Foghorns play on an interesting piece of science when it comes to making their sound travel for as long a distance as possible. Because it's not just about how loud they are, it's also about which note they play. I stood here directly in front of the band here. I can hear all three instruments very, very clearly. All of them are playing at pretty much the same volume, and it gives you this nice, balanced tune.
The instruments this band are playing are both high-pitched, the banjo, and low-pitched, the drums.
So I've come a little distance down to here, and I can still hear the band playing quite nicely there. And they're still playing the same volume, but the distance has changed the sound somewhat. It feels a little bit thinned out. Let's get further away, see what happens then.
Each instrument plays in its own range of frequencies. The banjo has high notes, but nothing low. The drum, however, is very, very low.
Right, well, coming all the way back here, that's changed everything. I can still hear the low, thumping sounds of the drums, but the higher notes of the banjo, I can't really hear them.
That's because the high-pitched notes that the banjo is pushing through the air are all high frequency, meaning that they travel via lots of short sound waves.
So those higher-pitched sounds coming from the banjo have pretty much lost all their energy. They've run out of steam before they even get to me. And that's why if you stand outside of a nightclub on a busy Friday night, pretty much all you can hear are the deep thuds of the beats and the low vibrations from the bass. And that's also why foghorns play out at such a low sound.
Thanks to the advances of the 20th century, keepers on rocks like the Fastnet witness fewer and fewer maritime disasters. But lighthouse technology was helpless against what was about to happen in 1979. The hundreds of competitors running the Fastnet yacht race used the lighthouse as their turning point. But on the 13th of August, 1979, some of them never returned. Gerald Butler was serving on the Fastnet when the world-famous race had its darkest hour.
It was a summer storm, and it was awful to be listening to these yachts and they're calling for help, and they're unable to do anything for themselves or unable to do anything for the yacht beside them either, because any slowing down of your progress left you in a position that you could be capsized yourself. And a lot of the yachts were losing the rudders. Without the rudder, the yacht was helpless. The water was pressing these yachts down into the sea. They were up to their knees in water on top of the decks of the yacht.
Gerald and the keepers on the Fastnet manned the radio and kept tally of which boats rounded the rock, so the Coast Guard knew which yachts were missing.
A yacht would come on and they would say, we've passed another yacht completely inverted upside down and no sign of life at all on it. We knew very well that this was going to turn out to be a terrible tragedy. We knew there was going to be a lot of people lost. We really hadn't an idea how many people or what the outcome was going to be.
The rescue effort became one of the biggest ever mounted in peacetime.
4,000 different rescuers came in on the scene. The Dutch Navy were out, the Royal Navy were out, RAF helicopters were flying. It turned out that ultimately 15 competitors were lost.
But if Gerald Butler and the keepers of the Fastnet hadn't been on station, many more lives might have been lost. The Fastnet's light still shines today, just as it did in 1979. However, 10 years after the disaster, new technology would change this lighthouse forever. The Fastnet Lighthouse, a 116-year-old engineering marvel that saved countless lives.
Lighthouses have been at the forefront of technology, if not the actual driving force behind so many scientific advances that are not just useful in the wider world, they're part of our everyday lives. So what next for lighthouses? What's their place in the 21st century?
The Fastnet was fully automated in 1989 and finally bade farewell to its last keeper. But Irish Light still maintains the tower to ensure its beacon shines for all shipping to see. Owen Lehane can help to shed some light on how much the Fastnet has changed.
This is a 1,000-watt high-energy discharge lamp.
1,000 watts?
Yes. This is the type of light source that was in the old lens on the Fastnet. And the type of LED rotating beacon that's now sitting on top of the dome at Fastnet. This here version of these lights, this is the lens.
Yep.
If you look into the lens, you will see yellow dot.
Is that a single LED? That's it?
That's what you're looking at through there. That's a single LED, 3 watts, with the lens, giving you 18-mile range.
This replaces that lamp with the enormous lens.
Correct. The entirety of the assembly is only about 30 watts in total.
Goodness me. A fraction of that one
a
lamp
fraction.
There. The technology behind these lamps is constantly
changing.
Progressing and moving forwards.
Yes.
Another way lighthouses are changing is that they're getting smaller and more numerous, in the form of the humble light buoy. I'm meeting Anthony Carey at Irish Light's headquarters to see how these buoys help to keep mariners safe in the 21st century.
We're constantly looking at new ways, new technology, and always, you know, incorporating new engineering into what we're doing. And we're working on an 8-year cycle.
What is it that limits the life of this to 8 years before it needs attention?
It's just the environment that they're in. So these guys, right out into the Atlantic Ocean, but when we put this out there, we really don't want it to fail.
The most important feature of these buoys is the lantern.
This is self-contained lanterns. So you can see this got solar panels on it. So during the day, this guy here will charge up the batteries on the inside. And then at night time, it will flash. You can see this is a red. So this guy will flash a red pattern of light.
Oh. Yeah, that... Ooh. That's a lot heavier than I thought that was going to be.
I have the privilege of topping out my very own mini lighthouse by attaching the lantern to this buoy.
All right, got my first bolt there. I'm somewhat feeling a little bit of pressure here. F-
feels like there might be consequences if I don't get this right. Well, I think that is nice and firmly on there.
Absolutely.
So what we've attached here, does that replace everything that's inside that day mark there?
Pretty much will do, yeah. Pretty much everything, as you can see, it's got the solar panels inside, it's charging up the batteries, and it's got its own lantern inside. And it'll transmit back that information to social media, to Twitter, and then we can react to that quicker. So if it's failed, we can put a plan in place then to come and repair that as quickly as possible.
These are smart boys, if you like.
Smart boys, yeah, met boys, yeah.
Wow, it's just, I mean, ever since lighthouses have existed, it's just this continuation of progress, isn't it?
Yeah.
So in the age of electronic navigation and light buoys that tweet, are lighthouses part of our future?
We have gone to GPS, but if onboard equipment fails with smaller craft, they are going to be thankful to have the light there.
Lighthouses would be considered in the category of visual aids to navigation, but the visual aids to navigation are still going to be required for the next 20, 30 years at a minimum.
There is a kind of magic to lighthouses. These unbelievably sophisticated and beautiful towers, which still work today, still do the job that they were supposed to do, represent a light in the dark.
Our seas are probably some of the safest in the world as a result of the efforts of these incredible people over the last few centuries.
So, the next time you go by a lighthouse, just give it a little nod for all the people and the lives that have been saved because it is a lighthouse.
The Fastnet represents the end of an era, the culmination of decades of innovation, and the masterpiece of stone lighthouse building in the British Isles.
Lighthouses have been the driving force behind so many huge leaps in science and technology. And to me, as an engineer, these seemingly simple structures are such powerful symbols of progress. But to the countless generations of mariners who've been kept safe at sea by the people who raise these lights in the darkness, a world without them is simply unimaginable.